The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. After our special on sight and circadian rhythms last week, this time we're going to go into the ear. Our reporter Anna Perman's been speaking to neurobiologists and experts in speech perception. We're going to hear from people who are studying hearing impairments and speech to find out why this particular sense is uniquely important in defining our place in the world. In other words, this is a podcast, well, sort of about listening to podcasts. Here's Anna with more.
While you're listening to this podcast, a lot of interesting processes are going on in your ears and your brain that you probably don't think about very much normally. We thought we'd tell you a little bit more about what's going on. So we talked to Professor Sophie Scott, who's a neuroscientist from University College London. While we were talking to her, she said something kind of interesting.
What we could have sort of stumbled on here is maybe a particular pre-existing brain condition.
But more about that a little bit later. First, let's get back to basics. Sophie told us a little bit more about what exactly sound is and where it comes from.
Imagine you're standing on the side of a boating lake and there are waves lapping up on the shore. And imagine that you dig a couple of channels in the shore so some of those waves are coming up into little further up. And imagine that you then had to watch the waves rolling up those little channels at the side of the shore. And from that, you were able to tell how many boats there were on the lake and where they were going. Because that's basically what you have to do in hearing. You only hear because we're surrounded by molecules that can vibrate. And most of the time, those molecules are air molecules. So when things happen that cause a sound, they cause those air molecules to vibrate. And it's those vibrations that are actually detected by our ears. And then our ears do an incredible amount of processing on the way up to the brain to actually be able to tease out things that actually mean that we can hear ourselves in a meaningful environment. I'm not surprised when I hear a clattering sound. I immediately know that that's somebody dropping a fork in the canteen. So this is an amazing technical problem for your ear. And of course, part of that is that your ear has to decode, change, transduce those molecule vibrations, the vibrations of the air molecules around you, into a signal that your brain can deal with. So it has to turn it into electricity. The first thing that has to happen is that when sound reaches your ear, those vibrating molecules vibrate up against your eardrum. That then vibrates three little bones in your inner ear, middle ear, which then moves a little window at the bottom of your cochlea, and that causes the fluid in the cochlea to vibrate, literally get waves in it. And it's those waves which move the hair cells, and the hair cells, which literally, everything's, this is all moving stuff, so the hearing all depends on things moving in your ears. Sounds only occur in the world because something's happened. If there was nothing happening, if there was nothing moving, there would be no sound. You know, a lot of the sounds that we are actually immersed in reflect actions and events, things occurring actually out there in the world. So, and I think that's why one possible reason why our auditory system is very, very fast, because sounds only exist because something's happened, and also they only exist over time. You can't take a photograph of a sound. You need some temporal information to be able to do anything with that sound. So it's a very, very fast, very, very dynamic sense hearing. Many, many years ago, in the days of payphones, I was standing in the lobby of my old polytechnic, which is a big sort of noisy marble room. And there was a chap in front of me on a payphone. And in those days, when you'd put in 20p and you only ended up using 10p, say, it'd be quite normal for people to turn around and say to the person behind them in the queue, would you like to, you know, use up the last of my money? So this guy turned around to ask me this question. But before he spoke to me, he had a stick and he rapped the floor with a stick. And then he asked me, and I realised afterwards that he was blind and he'd hit the floor with a stick to hear if there was anybody standing behind him in the queue. He was using echolocation in that sense. And it's now, there have been a few reports recently of examples of people with visual problems who actively go around making sounds and use the echoes made by those sounds to navigate. There was a chap on television a few months ago riding around on a bicycle and he was making sounds and using the reflections of the sounds as they came back to him as a way of actually guiding himself.
So the way that we hear is a crucial part of how we make sense of the world around us. And that doesn't just depend on us having fully functioning ears, but brains which know exactly how to interpret sound in order to build up a picture of our environment. But things can easily go wrong. Extreme noises like loud music or explosions can permanently damage our ears, as excessive pressure waves can burst eardrums or destroy hair cells in our inner ears. They can also have effects on our brains, which are a bit harder to pinpoint. Roland Scherter researches tinnitus at UCL, but he also has a more personal insight into the problems that this disorder can cause.
Hello, I'm Roland Scherter. I'm a researcher at the Ear Institute of University College London, where my research group tries to understand what tinnitus is, where it comes from, and maybe in the long run also how it can be treated. So I've been living with tinnitus for 14 years now, and my own tinnitus started in 1997. It was after a self-inflicted acoustic trauma. It was a whole weekend of loud music at the Love Parade 1997 in Berlin. Techno music, very loud. And it seemed like the thing to do at the time because I was living just around the corner from the festival. So I went there with friends for a whole weekend, and a few days afterwards, I noticed that there was a new sound in my ears constantly that had not been there before. I had the tinnitus almost constantly for half a year, and after half a year it suddenly got a lot better. It can be quite different sounds, for example a beeping or a buzzing or also noise-like sounds like a hissing or rushing, and most of the sounds are rather high-pitched. For example, my own tinnitus sounds a bit like the beep emitted by old TVs, so the TVs from the age before LCD and plasma TVs, the big bulky ones that give a very high-pitched beep when they're switched on. When you've got hearing loss, so when you had some damage to the structures of your inner ear, for example, due to noise, the ear is no longer as good at picking up sound as it was before. The brain then tries to adapt to this change. And as there's less signal coming in, it will just increase its internal amplification like you would do if you turn up the volume knob. So there's some change in the brain that the spontaneous activity is more like sound-evoked activity, and it creates the illusion of a sound.
So the brain is doing so much to the sound that we hear that it can add an entirely new noise that doesn't even exist. But the sound that goes on is interpreted by the brain in different ways. You may have experienced this if you've ever been in a noisy crowd and heard someone shout your name from a long way off. The information that's really important to you, that someone wants to speak to you, is the information that your brain decides to pick up out of the crowd noise, which isn't very useful. This just goes to show that your brain is treating different sounds in very different ways. Sophie's particular area of expertise is how we recognise speech sounds and how we differentiate them from other noises and treat them differently.
When we speak, we produce an incredible variety of different sounds. So we have noisy sounds like s, and we have voiced sounds like z, and then we've got sounds where we are moving our tongues to particular positions to create different resonances like r, air, or oo, that kind of spectral change is something that you really, really does seem to be specific to human speech. And then you've got periods of silence. So if I say bread, there's actually complete silence before I release the b sound. If you actually listen to the sound somebody's making, you've got all of these factors in there changing incredibly quickly. So we've got this amazingly complex sound. Interestingly, how you actually interact with the sound is very much dependent on what language you have learnt to understand. So it seems that when babies are born, they can actually discriminate between any speech sounds out there because they haven't learned which are the ones that are relevant for their language. But as you learn a language, as you learn to understand it and to produce it, you actually start to limit down the sounds that you will hear as speech sounds. A good example of this is the sounds like, or you know, a kissing sound like, they're called ingressive sounds because they involve you sucking a bit of air into your mouth. Now, English speakers absolutely do not hear those as speech sounds. We know behaviourally, people can hear them, they can make them, they don't treat them as speech sounds. If you look at somebody's brain, who's an English speaker, listening to those sounds, they're treated completely differently from equivalently short little bits of speech sounds like th or t. This is actually something which really is showing us that your brain is not treating these sounds as speech sounds. And this is important because they're in other languages of the world. So if you go to sub-Saharan Africa and talk to people who are members of the Zulu communities who might speak Xhosa, then these sounds like are all parts of speech sounds. If you listen to somebody talking, you will hear those sounds in there. Now, their brains are incorporating those as speech, and they're because they were part of what they acquired. So you've got an absolute difference in sort of the way that you can interact with sound, as whether or not it's a speech sound based on what you've learnt.
Sophie has been doing research with groups who focus on speaking and listening for a living by taking images of their brains during certain tasks. From this, her group are trying to work out exactly why certain people have extraordinary hearing abilities.
Once you're working with an adult who's acquired language, what you can find are very specific systems of the brain which are recruited when people listen to speech. It does seem that your brain is really geared to hear speech. So if you give the brain something that sounds a lot like speech, which isn't speech, it will still do a lot with it because your brain's sort of going, you know, great, right, is this someone talking? Is this someone talking? What's going on? Are there any words I can understand? And that's because we are absolutely communicating animals. We use language as our dominant medium for social interaction. And we're very, very social primates. Our brains are set up to be doing this in a highly automatic way. Something else that we've just recently published looked at the brains of people who are phoneticians, and phoneticians are the sorts of people who can listen to you speaking and then say, oh, I can tell that you've recently visited Montreal and that you probably spent some time also in Portsmouth, but you grew up in Leeds. We wanted to look at what was different associated with training to do this, because there's been a lot of work done with musicians, but of course musicians, really good musicians, start extremely young. So, you know, this is an example of a skill we could look at in adulthood. And what we found is we could find areas of the brain that were larger depending on how many years people had spent working as a phonetician. So the better you get at doing this kind of categorisation, or the longer you spent doing that. But we also found that their auditory cortex was bigger than non-phoneticians. And it was bigger because it was actually a different shape. So they literally have a more complex primary auditory cortex. And that's really on the left-hand side. And that's really quite striking, because that's very unlikely to have happened because of something that's to do with expertise. That's almost certainly something to do that actually happened with how their brain developed in the womb. So they this larger, more complex shape. So what we could have sort of stumbled on here is maybe a particular pre-existing brain condition that made them perhaps more interested in acoustic things like how people speak. So I'm sure we won't only find this with phoneticians, and it's possible that our impressionists will have this as well. Maybe people that work in studios, you know, people that work with sound will have this same sort of biomarker for auditory expertise. But it does suggest that there might be some basic reason why some people might find the world of sound and speech more interesting.
So it could be that some people are just more interested in sound than others, or perhaps they hear more detail in the sound that the rest of us can't appreciate. Obviously, we can never know exactly what other people are hearing. But research like Sophie's, which looks at our brain patterns, brings us one step closer to finding out. So, when we listen to, say, John Culshaw impersonating Brian Cox, it's worth remembering that the skill that he has is not just the way he speaks, but the way he listens. And it probably comes so naturally to him, he doesn't even realise that he's doing it.
See, the universe is massive, isn't it? It's great and big and massive. Just imagine the biggest bag that you've got in your cupboard. And space, right, is so big that it wouldn't even fit into that bag.
Comedian John Culshaw there, impersonating that TV physicist Brian Cox. Who knew he could do biology as well? Well, that's it for this week's programme. For more science news 24 hours a day, go to guardian.co.uk/science. There you'll also find the archives of this podcast. That's more than 5 years worth of stuff. Go and have a listen. This podcast was produced by Jason Phipps, Anna Perman and Ben Cape. I'm Alok Jha. See you again next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.